Hebrews chapter 11, and we've been covering the theme, if you could call it a theme, of the last few sermons of our God is worthy of trusting in. Our God is worthy of being faithful to. And really, we've been just digging into this idea of what does faith look like. And so last week, we really dug in and we looked at some of these aspects of faith in Hebrews 11. And to summarize the points, I said, according to Hebrews chapter 11, faith is something solid. It is something that we can put our trust in. Now, there was an illustration I didn't give you last week, but I do want to use it this week. And this is pulled from a commentary by F.B. Meyer. He uses this illustration of faith. And so I want you to kind of tuck this in the back of your mind. And I want you to apply it to the trust that we put in Christ. And he said this. He says, faith is a sixth sense. He said, it makes us as sure of the unseen or future things, which we know only about through divine word, as we are of things that we can see and touch. I think that's an important note. When we say that we have faith in something, I've used the illustration, it's following God's track record and saying he's been faithful in all of these things that we can check him on. I'm going to trust them for the things that I can't check him on. And so if you know a person really well and you hear a report or a rumor, you're going to be able to look at a track record of their life and go, they have absolutely no signs of doing anything like that in their life up till now. I'm sorry, you're going to need more evidence than your word to prove that they've done this thing that seems completely out of character. And you think about that, and that's what we call putting faith in a person, and putting faith in a person's character. When we talk about putting faith in God, what we are doing is we're looking at God's track record through history, and he's left us thousands of years of a track record. And we look at that faithfulness, and we look at him keeping his promises, and we look at him not acting irrationally, and we look at that track record, and we go, just as I can stand back and watch the pattern of someone's life and say, I really doubt that story. We can look at the pattern of God's life, if you will, and say, something he's doing right now seems to contradict his character, but I'm going to trust his character more than I trust my nerves. Now, to go back to the illustration this guy gives, he says, faith is a sixth sense. It makes us as sure of unseen or future things, which we know only about through divine word, as we are of those things which we can see and touch. When we are aware of the reality of these things, we naturally take them into account when we act. Now he's going to use an illustration. He says, Rothschild, he said he laid the foundation of his fortune because when he had news of the Battle of Waterloo that it had been won a day before anyone else in Britain, this fact enabled him to buy up all the depressed money shares, which then rose with marvelous buoyancy as soon as the news was universally disseminated. And so you've got this account in history of a guy who knew the battle was won. He was able to get a step ahead of everyone else. He bought up all these money shares because he knew once news that battle was won went out, what seemed like a foolish purchase was actually the best thing you could have ever done. And boom, instant wealth. The idea of faith is we are living for things that other people look at as foolish. I was talking to Pastor just recently, and you know, people think that if you stay in California and you serve in California and you work in California, you're stupid. You know, why would you do that to yourself? And it really is that God has called me to this. God has asked, not everyone, but he has asked people to be faithful and to serve in California, for instance. That doesn't seem like a wise choice. You know, California is not up there on the list of good places to raise your kids. California is not up there on the choice of cheap places to raise your kids or to live life. California is not up there on the man I feel safe list. You know, like I come from New Hampshire, you know, where worst comes to worst, you just go hide in the woods and you're fine for a while. You know, but California doesn't make any sense at all. But if it's a place where God has said, hey, I want you here, it actually makes perfect sense to say, you know what? I'm going to stick. I'm going to stay. And so just that's the idea of faith. You're not living for the temporal. You're not living for in the moment. You're living for eternity. Now he goes on and he says this, faith, using this illustration, does this for us. Noah built the ark because he believed that the flood would befall. Abraham left his country because he realized what Canaan would be his. The pilgrims and martyrs of all the ages have been derided by their companions, who would have acted similarly if they had only looked with faith at the unseen. And God never fails such. He always bears witness with his gifts. And so I think there's something to be said. As we look at this idea of faith, we covered this idea. We said, first of all, last week, faith is something that is solid. It is something tangible. God's track record is worth putting our trust in. It's not this, you know, blind leap of faith. Really, if you start, and it was amazing. I was working at the shop this week, and I got chatting with a couple, and we got talking apologetics and theology and all this. And we talked about those people who walk away from the faith, and it was the idea as we started discussing it, and I said, they're still going to have to do something with the fact that Christ existed. That's an inarguable fact. In fact, you go into scholarship, and there's very little doubt that Jesus Christ as a person existed. He's had too much impact on history for this to be a myth. There's literally a whole book written. The guy's J. Werner Wallace. He's a cold case detective. He wrote a whole book, and it's called Person of Interest. And what he does is he traces the story of Christ completely outside the Bible, using art, using other stories that have disseminated throughout cultures. He's like, you can go to universities. He's like, universities love to keep their old buildings. And a lot of these universities used to be Christian. And you can reconstruct almost the entire story of Christ by stained glass windows on some of these old universities. He said, you go to a lot of these hospitals. He's like, yeah, okay, they don't like to keep their old buildings as much. But if you have access to any of the old buildings where some of these hospitals started, you will see the story of Christ. He's like, there's songs, there's plays, there's stories. There's more stuff written about Christ than any fictional character in the history of the world. And he says, so that kind of implies that this isn't just an ordinary fictional character. I mean, up until they started doing some of the weird stuff with, you know, BCE and ACE and, you know, some of the dating methods, he's like, our entire calendar was centered around the life of this guy. There's something to it. And so you can get as offended as you want. You can turn on Christianity as much as you want. But the fact is, there are hard truths that you can't argue away. There are hard truths about the life and existence of Christ, what he did on the cross, the impact that had all throughout history. I mean, you can even look at some false religions like Islam and Mormonism and say, even those carry fingerprints of Christ's existence because they're based off of a twisted view, but a view of Christianity. And it's amazing, as you just see the ripples of Christ's life go out, we have to do something with that fact. We have to respond to that in some way or another. And so when we talk about faith being in something solid, there are actual historical evidences. There are actual truths. We're not asking to make a blind leap at something that has absolutely no proof behind it. And so as we talk about this faith, like I said, it's looking at God's track record up until now and saying, I don't understand the next few steps, which is another point I covered last week. I don't understand these next few steps, but I understand all of this and I trust it. And so as we talk about faith being something solid, that's exactly what Hebrews 11:1 says. It is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. We go further and we said faith is a means by which we please God. Again, we saw that through several passages. But what we do when we have faith in God, we are internalizing his promises. We are internalizing the witness that we have seen, and we're saying, because I have seen all of this faithfulness, I don't know what to do right now. I don't know how to stand right now. I'm nervous. I'm scared. I don't know what this looks like. But again, here's his record. I'm going to choose to trust. And so faith is that way that we please God because we choose to step out and live trusting what we've already seen. And that means we can step out into the unknown. Now, another point we made last week is the idea that you can have your faith in the wrong thing. The very fact that you have faith does not necessarily mean you have faith in the right thing. We brought up some of those false religions. We brought up some of those wrong thoughts. And so you must make sure that your faith is actually grounded in the truth. And I remember back when I first came to California, one of my struggles really was I wasn't sure whether I should come out or not. And I remember a friend of mine was like, well, just step out in faith, you know, just step out in faith and come to California. And I realized this is going to sound contradictory to what I just said a little bit earlier. But there wasn't a Bible verse I could go to say, thou shalt go to California. If there was, I would wonder what translation I was reading, to be honest. But if there was, that would make it really easy because then I could really step out and go, well, sure. You know, and then everyone else should too, because it would be in the Bible and you know, everybody would move to California. But you notice there isn't a set verse. And so there's a lot of people who are like, well, God spoke to me and I need to. But God does put burdens in your heart. God does lead you in certain ways. And I remember when we were planning to leave New Hampshire, it was like, so do we stay in New Hampshire or do we go to this place that God has very clearly put a burden in our heart for? You know, and it's like we don't have a huge burden for this location, but we have a big burden to help that location. Let's go. You know, and it was one of those things that we just decided to step out and say, God has given us this immense burden for this location. Why not? I mean, honestly, what do we have to lose? I mean, I know you're like, well, everything. I know. But in the long term, what do we really have to lose that isn't riskable anyway? Oh, no, I might lose some money. Okay. Let me just put it this way. I'm not saying God is going to do this in your life. But we stepped out, and I believe in faith, to come to California. And my wife and I, we budgeted, for instance, to save for a car. So we moved to California with our one car, and that was great. And then we started having these little things called children. And they're a little hard to fit in a Toyota Corolla, you know, if you have as many as I do. And so what we started to realize is, it's a little tight. It's a little squished. So we just kind of send out the message on Facebook to say, hey, anybody know of like, you know, just pray for us. We're trying to look for a new car. You know, what do you recommend? Stuff like that. Literally, I believe it was within weeks, her father, who works at a boys' home, so they're really, really rough on their vehicles, he got a hold of a car that actually wasn't terribly beat up that they were planning to get rid of. And so they gave him the car for free. And then he proceeded to fix it up because he's a mechanic. And then they proceeded to drive it out to California and give it to us. And you might go, well, I mean, that's because it's family. I mean, that's why that one happened. And you were totally fishing on Facebook. And it's like, okay, maybe. But the fact is, someone saw the post. Someone decided out of the blue to look into it. And they drove the car out for us. And so we didn't have to tap into any of our resources to buy a new car because someone literally drove us a new car out. Not new, but new to us. Drove us a van out and gave it to us for free. Pretty soon after that, our Toyota Corolla died. So we were down to one van. Well, when we started planning to have child number four, you know, you can't just fit four kids squished in the back of a van anymore. So we were looking for an 8-passenger van. Again, we asked on Facebook, anybody know of a good 8-passenger van? Like, keep your eye out for us. We had some friends in San Francisco who said, we have a van. Like literally, we have a van that we weren't using because, you know, COVID and we weren't driving kids to church anymore. So it's just been sitting on our garage. So, and I was like, okay, what do you want for it? And they're like, oh, we'll give it to you. Okay. So do you want us like to come pick it up? Nah, we'll drive it up. Now, just so you know, from San Francisco to camp is a 3-hour drive. Okay. So that's not just driving it across the street for you. That's a commitment. They not only did that, they went and had people look through the van to make sure it was good. They changed the batteries. They changed this and that and that. So they really fixed the van up and drove it to camp for us, which meant they had to drive two vehicles because, you know, you can't drive the van you're dropping off back to, you got it. All right. In our ministry at camp and otherwise, we had 2 or 3 vehicles given to us. So when we talk about like, oh, the risk and you could lose everything, we could. And there's still expenses and there's still sacrifice. But I'm just saying God's track record, at least in our life, has been to provide. He's been faithful. Let me give you one more illustration. When we chose to leave camp and we chose to make the announcement, it was about this time last year. I told the director, I said, hey, we're moving on and we're looking to get into potentially full-time church ministry. We're not sure. And so we talked it over, and so it was like, well, your last day of work, you know, will be end of November. We'll pay you till the end of December, and then we'll let you stay in the house as you try to figure things out for about another 2 months, and then you're gonna have to leave. So it was like, ah, that's fine. That's far more generous than you need to be. And so I waited until the end of November to kind of make the announcement to everybody. Well, a friend of mine who happens to run a business, the escape room, he saw my announcement and he was like, hey, you want to be my manager? And so out of the blue, I went from, I have no idea what's going to happen. I have no idea how I'm going to provide. I don't know how I'm going to stay in California because you need this little thing called a job. I can't rent a house because you need multiple months, if not years, worth of history. And you need potentially three times the pay in order to even get into these houses. Good luck. That's not going to happen. And so I proceeded to go, all right, well, I'm just going to work this job. And I told the guy, it's contingent on two things. I said, I need a ministry that I'm working in, and I need a house. So I am totally fine staying at the business, but I'm going to need those two things. And so we prayed about ministry. We looked at things, and I was like, I'm just going to keep going to my church and see what happens. And there was a house that popped up, and the house was going to be available beginning of March. They were going to do a walkthrough March 14th, and then potentially, maybe, sort of, you might be able to get into it. Now note, my due date to get out of camp housing was end of March. I can't wait. I can't afford to sit around and go, maybe, maybe. No, like I need to get in there. And so I told my boss, I said, hey, I need a house. Well, conveniently, he used to work in real estate. And so he was able to get a hold of the lady who we were talking to. He emailed her thoroughly, and he decided to step in to say, you know what? I will back you with the business, so the business will co-sign, so that way you can make sure you get in, and I will push them to deny every other applicant to take you instead. And so she canceled the open house. She let us move in at the beginning of March because we were having a baby. And I mean, it was one of those things where we were praying about it. We were saying, God, if you want us to be in California, these are the things that we're going to need because we need them. And it was like last minute domino of boom, 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 boom. All these things just fell into place. And we had to stand back and go, none of that made sense. Like, that was ridiculous. But that's what it's like to say, you know what? It's a risk. This whole experiment could end in failure. This whole adventure could end with me slinking back to New Hampshire with my tail between my legs going, I failed. Whatever. But that's not the point. The point is, if we say, God, I'm going to serve you, I'm going to commit to you one way or another, and you lead me where you want to lead me, that is what we're trusting in. That is what we're choosing to do. We are choosing to say, with the life choices that I make, whether they don't make sense or whether they do make sense, I am choosing to put God's glory first. I'm choosing to put his service first. Let come what may. And you think about all the things that you risk, and a lot of those things you risk are finances, comfort, freedom, you know, whatever it is that you put in that spot where you're like, I don't know how this is going to play out. Do you trust God's track record? Because you can put your trust in the wrong thing. That's why God talks about it is easier for a camel to go through the eye of a needle than for a rich man to get into the kingdom of heaven. Because he's so trusting in his riches that God looks at it and says, yeah, it's nearly impossible. Because his disciples even recognize that. And they go, well, how is that even possible? He's like, well, it's not. But with God, all things are possible. Because when you have the comforts of this world in mind, when you have assurance that you need to know everything, that makes it really hard to step out in faith. And so as we look through this idea of faith, faith is something solid. Faith is a means by which we please God. Faith must be grounded in the truth. And there are times where God is going to speak and we don't have anything else to compare it to, but we still need to step out in faith. And like I said, faith at times will require great sacrifice. That's what we covered last week. So now I get to the main sermon just in time to end it. As we continue looking at faith, though, faith is something where we have got to make Jesus Christ the focus. Take a look at Hebrews chapter 12. Now, I know we're in Hebrews chapter 11 because Hebrews chapter 11 builds up this crescendo. It's point after point after point after point after point, and it builds and it builds and it builds, and then suddenly you find yourself at the beginning of Hebrews chapter 12 going, woo. You know, it's kind of the a roller coaster. You know, where Hebrews chapter 11 just went through this guy after this guy after this guy after this guy and how he lived by faith and how he died by faith and how he sacrificed and all of these things. And so you read this beautiful hall of faith, as we call it, And then suddenly, the end of Hebrews chapter 11 is, these all, having obtained a good report through faith, received not the promise. You know, and so they died before Christ came and died on the cross. They hadn't received that promise yet. And it says, God having provided something better for us, that they without us should not be made perfect. Wherefore? Now, it's a good biblical pattern. Whenever you see the word wherefore or therefore, you ask, what is it there for? And so as you see these words, what they are doing is they are saying, go look at what you just read because I'm about to make a point about it. And so as you get to Hebrews chapter 12, verse 1, look what it says. It says, wherefore, with all of that said, with all of those points being made about faith and faithful people and people who lived for God up until the point of their death, sometimes very, very violently, he says, therefore, seeing we are compassed about, seeing we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses. And so it's almost like God is being brought to trial. And you've got all of these character witnesses who are coming up one after another and saying, I can speak for his faithfulness. I can speak for his faithfulness too. I can speak for his faithfulness. And you got witness after witness after witness coming up to the witness stand saying, yeah, I can speak to the truth of what he just said. Yeah, I can speak for that truth too. And person after person after person after person has spoken for God's character, has spoken for God's reliability, has spoken for God being there and doing what he said he would do. And he says, wherefore, seeing as we are compassed about, we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us have the faith, let us have this assurance, let us have the focus on Christ needed, that we are then going to lay aside every weight and the sin which does so easily beset us. And so he's talking about this unbelief. He's talking about this unfaithfulness, these sins which trip us up. And he's using the illustration of a race where I heard a guy say he ran a marathon one time, and you know, you got everyone sitting there on the starting line. They're all bundled up because it's cold and they're, you know, getting excited and going. He says they start running and they just start shedding pieces of clothing. And so you've got jackets flying and every extra little ounce of weight that could possibly slow them down, they're just chucking it. And he said it was just this weirdest thing as they started running this big old marathon, and they're just shedding anything that they don't need, and they're running in just what they absolutely need to run. And it's this illustration. He said, let us lay aside every weight. So all of these things that are tripping us up, all of these things that are holding us back, throw them away, especially if it's that sin. Now, I personally, and I know people disagree on this one, I personally believe the sin here that's being talked about because of the context is the sin of unbelief. There's a little more to it, but that's not the point of the message, and if you disagree, that's fine. But look at the context, because it's talking about this sin which so easily trips us up, this sin that so easily drags us down and holds us back. And again, you can make the case that, well, no, I think it's these other sins too. That's fine. But what is sin ultimately rooted in? Sin is ultimately rooted in pride, which is rooted in unbelief. So we can still say I'm right. No. But the idea is there are sins that are going to drag us down and trip us up and slow us down. And he's saying, why are you letting that happen? Why are you letting that hold you back? Cast it away. Get rid of it. And he says, and you need to run with patience. You need to run with this endurance, this race that is set before us. And I'll come back to that point later. But then look at verse 2. As you're running, just as a runner is looking toward that finish line and saying, that's my goal, that's the end result, that's what I'm trying to get to. I'm not just trying to, you know, take one more step and then quit. I'm trying to pace myself. And if you've ever done a race, which I haven't, but I've heard stories. But you've got those guys who are the pacemakers, you know, the guys, and you're like, well, if you want to do a, you know, what would be mine, like 24-minute mile, you know, whatever. And it's like, stay with this guy. And I don't know how those guys are that good, but you kind of know, all right, if I stay with this guy right here, I'm going to get done with a mile in this amount of time. And that idea of I'm going to run with patience. And so you might be like, well, you're not. No, you just endure. And you stick with it, and you commit to what you're doing, and you don't waste it all at the beginning. You know how the races work. And even if you don't, it's okay. You get the illustration, because I don't run. All right, but that idea of running with endurance, running with patience, But the end zone, the end result we're looking at is looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And look at what his end zone was, who for the joy that was set before him. So for what he was aiming for, he was willing to endure the cross. And in fact, the shame and that reproach that he was going to bear, which was so heavy on him, he despised it. He didn't think it even worthy of considering. He despised the shame. And so a lot of times we are nervous and scared and we hold back for various honor reasons. And when Jesus came down to it, he said, you know what? There's a shame to this. There is a disgrace that I'm going to have to bear for a short time where they're going to mock me. They're going to insult me. They're going to drag my name through the dirt. But I'm not thinking about the temporary. I'm not thinking about right now. I'm thinking about the joy that is set before me. And you look at the endurance he had, and he says he despised the shame, and then now he is set down on the right hand of the throne of God. For consider him that endured such a contradiction of sinners against himself, lest you be wearied and faint in your mind. You have not yet resisted unto blood, striving against sin. And so he's using this illustration to say, look at the testimony of Jesus. Look at what Jesus received. Look at the glory that Jesus received. Let him be your pattern and run the race that is set before you. And so as we talk about this idea of faith, and we ended on this last week, faith is one of those things that we have to set up a shrine to Christ in our hearts. And I use the illustration, as stupid as it was, of that web camera. And that time I was preaching on faith and I used this illustration and there was a web camera sitting right in front of me. And I was confused by it. And I got right up to it and was like, what is this? And I looked like, you know, the owls that hatch and start looking at the web camera. I mean, it was that annoying. And I was right up in the thing's face because it was so central and it was so obvious that you couldn't miss it. And as you study Peter and as you study other books of the Bible where it talks about giving an answer for the hope that is found within you, a lot of it boils down to, is Christ your focus or not? Make sure you set Christ apart in your heart. Make sure he is the one that is sanctified. I mean, even in heaven where you have the angels, what are they doing? They're drawing attention to Christ and saying, holy, holy, holy. I mean, they are literally drawing attention to him over and over and over because he is the focus. And what does the author of Hebrews do? He uses Jesus as the focus and the chief illustration. After faithful witness, after faithful witness, after faithful witness, what are they all pointing to but the finished work of Christ? And so we need to make sure that as we are being faithful, we are being faithful to Christ. We are being faithful to what he has asked. We are setting up a shrine, so to speak, in our hearts to him, so that as things get dark and as things get frustrating and we lose track of all these other things in the fog of war, we can still come back to that central focus, which is Christ. Because again, Christ has not necessarily asked us to win. You look at all of these witnesses in Hebrews 11. They died. I mean, he talks about them. They were sawn asunder. They were cast to this and they had that. They died. They, in the world schema, they failed. But God said, no, you didn't fail. I simply asked you to be faithful. I simply asked you to give a witness. I mean, you literally have Isaiah. And God says, Isaiah, you're going to speak to a people whose ears are fat and they can't hear you. And Isaiah goes, oh, okay. And Isaiah is more or less told at the beginning of his ministry, these people won't listen. Isaiah's job wasn't to make them listen. His job was to deliver the message. That was it. You look at Noah. Noah was building an ark. That was what God asked him to do. So Noah built an ark and the people mocked him for it because, oh, come on. You're telling me everything's going to flood. You're building a big boat. Oh, you moron. But what is it? He simply asked to build the ark. And you notice the only people he saved was his own family. And so that is this idea. I mean, even Abraham, he was told, you're going to have descendants as the sand of the seashore. He didn't see that. We know it's true. We know that when you count Abraham's descendants, yes, they are uncountable. But in Abraham's life, He's just a guy that traveled around, lived in tents, was fairly rich, but still lived in a tent, traveling around. And he died without seeing children, the sand of the seashore. But to him, it was as good as done. And so as we keep Christ our focus, it will keep us on target. Again, if we continue, hop back to Hebrews chapter 11, look at verse 11. Hebrews 11, verse 11. Another point about faith here, it says, through faith, Sarah herself received strength, to conceive seed, and was delivered of a child when she was past age, because she judged him faithful who had promised. Therefore sprang there even one from him as good as dead, so many as the stars of the sky in multitude, and as the sand which is by the seashore, innumerable. These all died in faith, having not received the promise, but having seen them afar off and were persuaded of them and embraced them and confessed that they were strangers and pilgrims on the earth. And so as we look at this idea in faith, there are going to be times where we do not receive the promise. I love to bring up the fact, as you study the life of Abraham, he literally wandered around for 24 years before he got the promise of Isaac. 24 years. He left his home at 75 years old, wandered around, went to Egypt, came back, went there. He was 99 years old before God showed up and said, next year, this time, you're going to have a son. That was a man who learned endurance. That was a man who learned patience. And I think a lot of the pitfalls Abraham fell into, they were sin, don't get me wrong, but I believe they were well-motivated, because there were a lot of them where he was trying to keep himself alive. Almost like he thought he had a hand in it. But you look, when he went down to Egypt, what did he do? Well, if I tell them you're my wife, they're going to kill me. So I need to be alive. So you're my sister, which is a half-truth. So, you know. And then you look at some of the other things he did where you're like, Abraham. You know, and what God was slowly doing is stripping away all the things that Abraham was depending on to say, no, no, no. I'm bringing you to the end of yourself. You have no more rope to hold on to. So that way you're going to have to trust me completely. And Abraham did. And then God proved it later on when he said, hey, Abraham, I need you to take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and I need you to offer him in sacrifice to me. And, you know, we find out later on as you get into Hebrews and other things that Abraham basically figured God would bring him back from the dead. Because you know what? God had promised. And God's promises come true. And so if God said, this son whom you're supposed to kill is going to be the father of many nations and he has no kids yet. Well, there's only two options there. Either God's not going to let me kill him, or God's going to bring him back from the dead. And either of those seem completely within God's power. So let's just keep going with this. And so Abraham goes all the way up to the top of the mountain. He has the wood. He has the end. And he just says, you know what? God's going to figure it out. I'm just going to obey. And you look at Abraham's life, and it was a life of trying to do it his way, but still trying to follow God's facts. And slowly, thing after thing after thing, as you follow Abraham's life, was stripped away until Abraham realized, I just got to fully commit to what God has said. I need to stop trying to figure this out. Because you notice, as you go through his life, he's like, is it going to be through my servant? Because, you know, that would work. And God's like, no. He's like, okay. How about through Hagar? And God's like, no, it'll be through Sarah. You know Sarah can't have kids, right? Yeah, Sarah's going to have kids though. Okay. So how's that going to, you know, and like Abraham just goes through his whole life where you see God slowly pulling more and more pieces out from under him saying, you just got to trust me on this one, Abraham. It's not going to be through your servant. It's not going to be through Hagar. It is going to be through Sarah. Just wait. And Abraham just continued to live by faith, and he continued to step out, and he continued to grow to the point where he was willing to say, all right, God, I don't know how you're going to do this, but I'm just going to step out and see what you do. And he proved God faithful yet again. And so as we step out in faith, there are times where our faith will not be sight. We won't see what God's doing, or there might be times where we won't see it in our own lifetime. But that's not the point. Point number 8, if you are keeping track of points, we have to keep our eyes on Christ and his word. Again, you can see some points that we've already made here, but as you go through specifically Hebrews 11 verse 15 and others, it would say things like this: "And truly, if they had been mindful of that country from whence they came out, they might have had opportunity to return." And what we see here is Abraham and so many other people who walked this path, God called them to do something. And he said, basically, "I want you to remember my promise and I want you to hold to it." And so what they did is they forgot the land they came from. They stopped looking back at Ur or other places to say, "Oh man." And you notice in the Bible, there are those who chose not to do that. The most prominent example I can think of is the children of Israel and the mixed multitude that comes up out of Egypt. What do they promptly start doing when things get tough? They start complaining. And if you look at the content of their complaint, it is the most mind-boggling complaint ever. Here is a group of former slaves who is coming up out of Egypt. Here are a bunch of disgruntled mixed multitude who, for whatever reason, were not happy in Egypt, and so they choose to leave with the children of Israel. And so you've got all this crowd of people who are basically the discontents, the former slaves. These were people who did not have a good life in Egypt, and they are choosing to leave Egypt to go to the promised land. And what does God do? He takes them into the wilderness a few days to where they're now really thirsty. In fact, it says he takes them about 3 days into the wilderness, which is the amount of time it takes to start dehydrating. They have no water. They have all this cattle. They start freaking out, going, "How on earth will God provide for our water?" And that's when God provides them water. And so he miraculously says, "I am going to take you up to the brink and then provide that need to show you I know what the brink is and I know how to provide it." And so what God is doing is he's teaching them, "I can take you all the way up to a line, but I'm not bringing you out here to kill you. Trust me in this." Okay, they struggle with that test. And he takes them a little farther and they don't have food. Again, "I need food to survive." And so what does God do? He provides them food. And so what he's doing is he's trying to teach them, "I can bring you to the brink, but I know where the line is. I'm not going to accidentally hurt you." You know, I think about the times I've been punched in the face. And it was when I was a kid. I had a friend who was playing around and he's like, "Ha, ha, ha." And he went like this. And he didn't know how to pull his punch back in time. And he punched me in the face. And I was like, "Are you kidding me?" And he's like, "Oh, I'm sorry." And then later on, he did the same thing. And so ultimately, I got to the point where I'm like, "I'm not letting you fake punch me anymore, man, because you punched me in the nose twice because you round up and you're like, ha, 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 and you don't pull your punch in time and you get me." And it's like, I don't care whether you meant to punch me or you didn't mean to punch me. The fact is you still punched me. No, you're not doing it again. That's not what God's doing. God's not fake punching the people of Israel going, "Oops, killed a few of you." No, he's bringing them to a line to say, "Do you trust me in the plentiest times? And do you trust me when I bring you to the brink? And then you have to wait on me to provide." And so as you look at some of these things, there's this faith where you don't quite see it and you have to keep your eyes on God's promise. And what happens with the children of Israel? Their memory goes so bad that they start going, "We remember when we had the leeks and the garlics and we had all the food we could ever want." And you're like, "I don't know if I read the story wrong, but you were slaves who were crying out because things were so bad that's why you wanted to get out of Egypt. This wasn't a resort, you know? It wasn't like, oh, we remember when we sat and we had the flesh pots where we could eat all the meat we wanted." No, you didn't. And even if you say, well, it was the mixed multitude. Well, apparently they were unhappy enough that they decided to give it all up to follow the children of Israel too. They didn't have the flesh pots and all the vegetables and everything that they could ever want. Their memory was bad. And so again, as we keep our focus on Christ and God and the work that he's done, it will keep us focused so we stop looking back with a bad memory on what we had before. Finally, look at verse 19 of Hebrews chapter 11. Hebrews chapter 11, verse 19. And again, I'll start reading in verse 17. "By faith, Abraham, when he was tried, he offered up Isaac." And we talked about that already. And he that had received the promises offered up his only begotten son. Again, I love the image here of what Christ would eventually do as well. But of whom it was said that in Isaac shall thy seed be called, accounting that God was able to raise him up, even from the dead, from whence also he received him in a figure. And I want to close on this point and just make a few quick applications before I dismiss you. When we live by faith, we will see wonders. When we live by faith, when we choose to trust a faithful God, when we choose to put our faith in the right thing, we will see wonders. We talked about this idea of salvation last week. And we said the idea of faith, where you're putting your faith in the finished work of Christ, it's like sitting in a chair and saying, I'm not going to rely on anything else. I think that's one of the ultimate wonders, that one day we will get to stand and see our God. And he will look at us and say, well done, good and faithful servant. Like, I think that is the most mind-numbing wonder of it all. That us, and you know your own sinfulness, you know your own failings, you know your own unworthiness. And the fact that the God of the universe, if we are saved and we've, you know, he'll look at us and say, well done. I mean, that's amazing. But that's the work of Christ on us. That's the finished work of Christ doing a work. And I don't understand all that, but that's amazing. But even in our temporal lives, I mean, look at what Abraham saw. Look at the stories Abraham got to tell. Look at what Abraham got to witness because he simply stepped out in faith. Because he chose to be faithful to God. And it really was one of those things, if you look at the life of Abraham, it doesn't make a whole lot of sense. I mean, Abraham really tread new ground. He didn't really know this God. He didn't have a whole Bible worth of witness to go on. He just simply said, sure, let's go for it. We have a whole Bible of witness of God's faithfulness. And we struggle more than Abraham does to live by faith and to step out in faith. But look at what Abraham got to see. I mean, his wife was 90 years old when she had a baby. That's pretty amazing right there. That's astounding. And it said, like, she was counted as dead. I mean, like, there's no way that should have happened. And it did. And he got to see that miracle. And he got to see Isaac get raised. And he got to see, I mean, some of the judgments and other things that God did. He got to see those. It was a life of faith. So what conclusions do we make from all this? First of all, if you think about Hebrews chapter 12, as we look at faithfulness and we look at the track record of God, as we've already kind of touched on, we need to make sure that any weight, any sin that is going to hold us back from being faithful, we're getting that taken care of. Now, it could just be a weight. It could be something that's not necessarily a sin. If it's there and it's holding you back from faithfulness to God, get rid of it. Especially if it's a sin. And so he says, that sin that so easily besets you, get rid of it. And so is there sin that is holding you back from faithfulness to Christ? Is there sin that's holding you back from full faithfulness? If so, make that right. If we confess our sins, he is faithful and just to forgive us our sins and to cleanse us from all unrighteousness. Second thing here, look at Hebrews chapter 12. We've already looked at this. Run with patience the race that is set before us. Let me make 2 points out of this verse. First of all, we need to endure. There is an endurance required here. There is a stick with itness. All right? There is a, I am going to stick with the stuff in the good times and the bad. I love that verse that Paul notes. He says, I have learned to basically abound, and I have learned to be abased. I have learned to be prosperous. I have learned to suffer want. I mean, he goes through both sides of the spectrum and says, I've been on both ends. And he says, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. And so what Paul is using as an illustration is, whether you're successful or whether you're a failure, the fact is, both of those times, Christ still needs to be your focus. And that's why being successful is so dangerous, because we get to the point when we're successful that we think we've got enough crutches underneath us that we don't really quite need to trust the way we were. On the other hand, as failure starts setting in, that's when bitterness and other things start to kick in, when we're like, well, God's not dealing with me the way I want him to. But again, remembering his track record, where he knows how to bring us right up to the line. He knows how to take us to the point of trust where we really have to trust him. And he knows how to provide. God is not someone who is going to punch you in the nose by accident. Again, if you want more evidence of that, take a look at Lamentations chapter 3. Lamentations chapter 3 is a whole passage where Jeremiah is watching God's judgment getting poured out on the wicked, and there are righteous people around that are being caught up in that same judgment, because when you judge a city, there are people in that city that they're being judged too. But what God is trying to say is, listen, and as you read through Lamentations 3, it's of the Lord's mercies we're all not consumed. And it's one of those gut checks, and it's one of those resets in your mind to go, whether things are going really, really well or really, really badly, we need to remember looking unto Jesus. But look at the last part of that verse for the other point that I was going to make. It is the race that is set before us. Now, the way we read it, we don't typically draw attention to the last word in that verse. We're just like, run with patience the race that is set before us. But it's a subtle little thing, but I think it's important. You've got that little word, us, buried at the end of that verse to draw attention to the fact that there are races that God has given to us. Now, personally, I don't believe God has called me away from California. There have been too many things that he has worked out to say stay. Now, do I have a strong desire at times to go back to New Hampshire and all? Yes, of course. Just the way it is. But this is the race, personally, that God set before me to stay. I can't look down on people who God has drawn out of California. And I've seen pastors do it. I've seen lay people do it. I think you should prayerfully consider the alternative just to make sure. But we have to understand that there are races that are set before us, and there are other races that are set before other people. The path that we are all called to walk is the path of holiness, the path of faithfulness. But there are locations that differ. And so just be very careful in your judgment of other people's servants, because there are times where God calls people for a season and then calls them away. There are times where God doesn't call people at all and says, nope, you're right where I want you. We don't know. And so what we need to do is say, what has God called me to do? And again, holiness, serving God, that faithfulness to God, that is what he's called all of us to do. Make sure you're doing that. And then finally, to close on, is where we touched quite a bit on. We need to make sure that we're looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. It's so easy to get sidetracked. It's so easy to get distracted on other things. But we need to remember who we are doing this for, and that is Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith. And again, I love how Hebrews 12 puts it, where it just beams right in on the sufferings of Jesus, beams right in on all that Jesus has been through. If I can close with a not so silly example, but a more secular example. There's a man who wrote a book. His name is Viktor Frankl, and I'm not sure how familiar you are with Viktor Frankl. Viktor Frankl survived the concentration camps during World War II. Came out of it, and he wrote a book on his experience. And what he noticed is the concentration camp was one of those places where you could just choose to die at any moment. And he said you could see it in people's eyes. When you're in the concentration camps, he said, they kind of picked it and they said, that guy's next. They could kind of tell when people were checking out, when they were about to just give up on life. And he said, but there was a movement in the camp at a certain point because of all the suicides to really start pushing people to not go there. And so what they did is they started trying to find the reason people had to keep going. And he said, it was the weirdest thing. He said, sometimes a week felt like it went faster than a day. He said time had no meaning at all in the concentration camps because there was just nothing to live for. It was mindless work. It was torture. And he just said it when you lost hope, you lost everything. And he said what they started trying to do to get people to not commit suicide is to focus on a goal. to focus on a reason to keep living. And he said, for one guy, it was a son that was there who no one else could father. And he was just determined to stick with it, with the idea that his son was worth living for. And it gave the guy enough hope to stick with it and not give up. He said, for another guy, he said it was a scientific paper he hadn't finished writing. And so this guy, he's like, there's no one else who can finish that scientific research. You need to survive this camp so that you can make it out. And he said, there was one guy who was convinced that he had had a dream. And in the dream, someone had said, you can ask for anything, any knowledge you want. And so the guy was like, when am I going to be freed? And he says, well, March 31st, that's when the war is going to be over for you. And he said, it was like February at this time. And the guy was all buoyed with hope. And he said, as he got closer and closer to that date, he realized that rumors of the war coming in were it wasn't going to end on March 31st. And he said, as this guy, buoyed with hope because he put his faith in the wrong thing, he came to this date and he said, March 29th hit and suddenly the guy got really sick. March 30th hit, the guy wasn't even moving. By March 31st, the guy had died. And by all the hospital reports with the camp, it basically he died of, I believe it was typhus. He said, that was ridiculous. He said, we all had it. Said we were all suffering with it. That guy died because he chose to give up hope, because he put his hope in the wrong thing. He was so determined. He was so convinced that March 31st would be his date of release that he put all his hope in that date. And as that date came and went, he just realized everything I put my hope in is dashed. And he said, what we came to discover in dealing with these various people, if you can convince someone of a why to keep going, they can manage anyhow. And he said, as we dealt with these guys, like the guy who basically was convinced it was worth sticking with it because you have a son waiting for you, or it's worth sticking with it because you have that scientific paper you haven't finished. He said that gave him enough hope, enough determination, enough buoy to keep with it in all the suffering. Let me take that and let me apply it to this focus on Christ. Because again, God never promises this is going to be easy or fun or lovely. In fact, Hebrews 11 goes through in gruesome detail all these saints that didn't make it. But they died in faith because God's promises and what God has said is the why that is worth living for in all of the how. And I think that's a powerful thing to remember, that as we are facing the persecution, as we're facing the unknown and the disheartening things that come along with that, we stick with the stuff because God's track record has shown himself to be faithful. The eternal power of God has shown that he has not abdicated the throne. God's nature has shown that he knows exactly how to bring us to a lip, but he's not going to shove us off. He knows how to bring us to the edge of our needs, and he knows how to provide them. And so if there's one thing I can leave you with, it's in this idea of faithfulness. Christ is worthy of us putting our trust in. He is worthy. He has proven himself over and over again to stick with it because he has stuck with it. Because he is worth. He's that why that is worth living for. And so I challenge you, read through Hebrews 11 and 12. Read through Lamentations chapter 3. Put these verses in your mind. And as you struggle with faith going forward, remember some of these points. But remember that God's track record is such that he is worth putting our trust in. Let's close in prayer, and then I'll turn it over for announcements. Dear Heavenly Father, I thank you for this day. I thank you, Lord, for all that you've given us. I thank you for your word. I thank you for your track record. I thank you for how great of a God that you are. And Lord, I just pray that you would help us to be faithful. I know it's not an easy thing you've called us to. I know it's not a comfortable thing you've called us to. But I just pray that you would help us to trust you more and more each day and see the wonders that you have. I thank you, Lord, and I pray this in your name.